How safe is an undocumented immigrant in a sanctuary city?
As we know, the detention and deportation system can happen pretty quickly here, and we want people to not only be safe and know their rights, but be prepared in case of an emergency.
Welcome to the Feet in Two Worlds podcast. I'm John Rudolph in San Francisco. Just days after being sworn into office, Donald Trump signed an executive order aimed at cities and states that protect undocumented immigrants. The order says, in part, sanctuary jurisdictions across the United States willfully violate federal law in an attempt to shield aliens from removal from the United States. And it goes on to say, these jurisdictions have caused immeasurable harm to the American people and to the very fabric of our republic. Demonstrations have been held on an almost daily basis to protest the administration's immigration policies. Sanctuary cities say they stand behind and value the immigrants who live within their borders. But how effective can local and state governments be in protecting undocumented workers and families? And what should undocumented immigrants expect as the struggle over sanctuary cities plays out? We're in San Francisco because this city is at the forefront of the sanctuary city movement. In the studio with me are Lena Graber and Kemi Bello from the Immigrant Legal Resource Center. Lena is the Special Projects Attorney, and Kemi Bello is the Communications Manager for the ILRC. And joining us on the line from her office in New York is Commissioner Nisha Agarwal, Commissioner of the New York City Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. Welcome to you all. Commissioner Agarwal, New York calls itself a sanctuary city. What does that mean? What does that mean in practical terms?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I actually think the terminology of sanctuary city or not is not as important as actually the policies that kind of underlie being an inclusive city for all. So in New York, that means a number of different things. We have a citywide municipal identification card that's available to all regardless of immigration status. We have strong policies on language access, on making sure all of our city services are accessible sort of within existing law, regardless of immigration service status, including healthcare and education. And we have sort of smart rules about the extent to which local law enforcement collaborates with or doesn't collaborate with ICE, with a view towards really protecting public safety and building community police relations. So I think it's less about whether we call ourselves a sanctuary city and more about how we act on policies that are inclusive.
And we should just say that ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. I understand your point, but yet a lot of people are using this term sanctuary cities, and the Trump administration executive order specifically refers to sanctuary. Lena Graber, there are hundreds of sanctuary cities and counties across the country. According to the LA Times, the number stands at about 400. Are they all doing the same thing that New York is doing, or is this term interpreted differently in different places?
It's definitely interpreted differently in different places. I strongly agree with Commissioner Agarwal that the label sanctuary is very much a question of symbolism and a message that you want to send or not send to the community, and that is somewhat distinct from the specific policies that a jurisdiction enacts.
Sanctuary city is not a legal term.
It was not a legal term. The executive order that President Trump signed a Wednesday or two ago kind of proffers a definition of sanctuary city, which is a jurisdiction that is willfully in violation of a federal statute at 8 U.S.C. 1373. That's just proposed in the executive order. There's no other kind of basis for that definition, and it's not the one that is popularly applied. So that sort of remains to be determined if that becomes the legal standard and a legal definition of sanctuary.
And how is sanctuary city interpreted on the ground in San Francisco?
In San Francisco, we have a really long tradition of calling ourselves a sanctuary city, and I think that speaks to a desire to make immigrants feel welcome, to feel part of the community, and to know that the local government sees them as valued constituents and is willing to protect them. I think one of the important things that comes from a lawsuit that San Francisco filed, but all of the places that are seeking to enact, quote, sanctuary policies, whether or not they call them that, it's a really misleading message coming from the federal government that these policies are in violation of federal law. They aren't. They are very much expressions of local governments dealing with their local priorities and using their resources according to what is important to them. And in most cases, that's about treating immigrants fairly and making sure that their communities and their residents feel safe. And that's absolutely within the authority of local governments to do.
Kemi Bello, you work for the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, so you're involved in this issue on a policy level, but it's also personal for you because you are an undocumented immigrant who could be impacted by changes that occur in Washington. So how are you feeling now? Do you feel reassured by the fact that you live in a city that is especially welcoming to immigrants and upholding of this idea of sanctuary? Or are the changes that are coming from Washington, from the White House, are they concerning you, worrying you?
I think it's safe to say that it's a mixture of both of those things. On the one hand, I think it's both a, you know, tremendous privilege to live in a place like the Bay Area where not only are there these policies in place now, and as Lena mentioned, this willingness to defend these policies via, you know, lawsuits against the federal government and other things, but there's a longstanding tradition in terms of welcoming immigrants, in terms of immigrants being such a huge and important part of the fabric here in San Francisco and how this region was built overall. So living in a place that you know, unashamedly and proudly not only recognizes and acknowledges but celebrates his immigrant heritage is hugely important to me, to be able to know that I live in a place that values me not just because of where I was born, but because of the contributions that I and other immigrants who now call San Francisco home are able to bring. At the same time, it's also a time of uncertainty and a time of fear, not only for, you know, young people like myself who do have the extra protections that programs like DACA provide, but for our families, for our grandparents and our parents who might not be afforded those same protections.
Have you made any changes in your life as a result of what's happened since the new administration has taken office?
So there are multiple things that we recommend as the Immigrant Legal Resource Center that people take into account. One of the big things are people just generally knowing their rights, whether they come in, you know, contact with law enforcement or immigration enforcement, knowing the rights that they have as someone, you know, regardless of immigration status. Another important step that I've started to take, and I strongly encourage other people to take who are in my same situation as well, is to make an emergency plan for yourself. We have resources on how to do this on our website, and it essentially entails, you know, spelling out your, you know, the documents and any personal effects, you know, regarding your immigration case or so on and so forth, and making sure that those are all compiled in the case something happens to you. As we know, the detention and deportation system can happen pretty quickly here, and we want people to not only be safe and know their rights, but be prepared in case of an emergency. It's a weird thing to have to do, essentially, to prepare to be, you know, to enter the system that seems very scary. But it's also very empowering to know that one of the biggest things that we say within sort of the undocumented youth movement is the more out you are, the safer you are. The more people who know about you, the more people who know, you know, if you were to disappear one day in the middle of the night. So I strongly encourage people to take the steps and the precautions that are available to them proactively to make themselves safe.
Commissioner Agarwal, the Trump administration says sanctuary cities like New York should stop protecting undocumented immigrants. There are immigrant rights activists who are saying that places like New York and San Francisco, who have done a lot, should do even more. Do you think New York is doing enough to support the undocumented immigrants in the city, or is there more that you should do and could do?
You know, I think that's a big question. And my sort of response is that we're always constantly working with our partners, community partners here in New York and many other stakeholders to sort of understand how we can continue to serve immigrant New Yorkers across the board. There was obviously a tremendous response to the president's Muslim ban executive order. And we immediately, the city, along with legal services partners, community activists, others, kind of found themselves at JFK Airport looking to respond. So I don't think that's going to change. And I think for longer term policy solutions where there's a need, we're going to be very responsive to that. That said, I also think that we're going to fight back against claims that our sort of pro-immigrant efforts are somehow running afoul of the law, as was mentioned before. I think we feel very confident we're in compliance with all of the laws that we need to be in compliance with. And we will take action, even if that means filing lawsuits or being able to respond in some way if these policies are challenged.
Now, the New York State Attorney General has filed a lawsuit or is party to a lawsuit, as I understand it. Is the city also taking legal action to challenge any of the executive orders from the White House?
One of the things that the mayor was very clear about is that if, for example, you know, the Sanctuary City executive order right now essentially says that Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice can take action to potentially pull federal funding from so-called sanctuary jurisdictions. If they actually take that action, we're willing to challenge that right now. We are sort of keeping a close eye on how some of these things move and figuring out if our intervention in other lawsuits that may be pending makes sense as well.
Well, let me ask you about this whole question of federal funding, because New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer issued a report where he estimated that the city could lose up to $7 billion in federal funding as a result of not complying with new federal policies regarding immigrants. I don't think it was just about sanctuary cities, but a variety of policies. I mean, first of all, that's a huge amount of money, a huge hit to the city, but also how accurate is that? Could that really happen?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I actually think there's a huge amount of legal work and legal debate about what exactly the federal government can do, right? So we have actually a number of different cases that even most recently, the Affordable Care Act, right, that were opinions sort of written by a conservative judge, Justice Roberts, that said that states and cities can't be coerced into complying with federal, federal obligations, certainly not to the point where it's so coercive that they're taking such a huge portion of city funding. There are rules that govern what kind of funding can be sort of held but based on the type of laws that you're trying to protect. I think one thing we're nervous about is the Sanctuary City's jurisdiction or executive order seems to be suggesting that it might be criminal justice funding. And for an executive order that's meant to be promoting public safety, it seems quite odd that they would want to pull criminal justice funding from a city like New York or any other city across the country. So I think there's a lot of discussion here, and a lot of the legal analysis, I think, suggests that the federal government does not actually have the power to pull all of our federal funding, certainly not to the tune of $7 billion, but that has to be, I think, played out in the courts.
Lena Graber, you consult with municipalities, cities, towns, counties all over the country who are interested in either reinforcing their sanctuary cities laws or policies or instituting new policies. And tell us, first of all, very briefly, you've been getting a lot of calls from jurisdictions that never had a policy like this who want to institute it.
That's right. They may have had policies like this. They may be strengthening them. But we've been seeing reaction to the election and the threats to immigrant communities, the response from local governments and advocates across the country is that they need to take active steps to make policies to protect their residents. And we've been advising them on the legal issues involved in that and how the immigration enforcement system works and what are some of the key aspects of those policies that they should be looking into.
And are they also asking you about this issue of withholding federal funding if they enact these policies?
Absolutely.
And what are you telling them?
Well, along the lines of what the commissioner said, there are a lot of legal and constitutional impediments to just this sort of threat of wholesale defunding from the federal government. And so there are ways to push back on that. At the same time, it is making people afraid. We saw this crazy action in Miami where they have a policy of that was enacted a couple years ago of not holding people on ICE detainers, which are a mechanism that is a request from ICE to a local law enforcement agency saying, you have someone in your custody that we're interested in, please hold them for us after they would be released so that we can come get them.
After they're released.
After they should be released, exactly. And the federal courts have roundly criticized that mechanism as being in violation of the Fourth Amendment and or ICE's own statutory authority. And so hundreds of jurisdictions across the country have stopped complying with ICE detainers. It was a pushback against the Secure Communities program that kind of issued tons of those detainer requests. And so,
which was enacted during the Obama administration.
That's right. And so many of those jurisdictions, I should say, don't hold people on detainers because they're concerned about threatening the immigrant community, but also because they don't want to be violating the Constitution and holding people in violation of the Fourth Amendment. So it's quite shocking to see Miami turn around and say, well, we're so afraid of the threat from the federal government that we're going to start violating the Constitution. We'll have to see how that plays out. But that's not something that the federal government can coerce through funding is to have people violate the Fourth Amendment.
Commissioner Agarwal, Kemi was talking earlier about this idea of making a contingency plan. Is that something that your office, that New York officials are advising immigrants, undocumented immigrants in New York to do as well?
What we're doing in New York is having sort of partnering with community-based organizations and others to do Know Your Rights forums in immigrant communities across the city. We tend to emphasize for sort of our portion of the Know Your Rights forums, the city services that remain available, the kind of resources that New Yorkers have, for example, if they've been the victims of a bias or discriminatory action or a hate crime, things like that. And then often our community partners may share information about how to get prepared. I think we want to, as a city, also be thoughtful about not sending a message that people should be very fearful. They're already quite fearful in the post-election moment, so we want to make sure the right messenger is also sharing some of the preparedness information and that we as the city are reminding folks that we are open and accessible to all.
So we've been talking about government at various levels, but what about schools, churches, universities that are also declaring themselves sanctuaries? Is there any connection between those institutions and the governments in those municipalities? Lena?
There are a ton of different campuses and churches. I mean, the origin of the sanctuary movement in many ways comes from churches that were concerned about protecting families or different refugee groups, etc. And those policies are important as well. They tend to, the jurisdictional structure behind schools tends to be somewhat different and separate from local governments, but also related, but they tend to sort of develop parallel policies that govern the way a campus or a school district is going to operate. And at ILRC, we focus particularly on the law enforcement policies more than campus, not because the campuses aren't important, but immigration enforcement has very much sought to conscript local law enforcement into being deportation agents over the last many years. And so that is where a lot of the rubber meets the road in terms of threats to the immigrant community.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh said anyone fearing deportation can move into City Hall as a safe place. Can he do that?
Will they be safe in City Hall?
Exactly.
Or can they move there? It depends. I don't know where he means in City Hall. Generally, If there is going to be an arrest by law enforcement, then they have fairly expansive power in a public place. But if they're going to go into a private area that isn't open to the public, they're going to need a warrant. And so it depends on if federal agents would have a warrant to go get people in that space.
Commissioner Agarwal, what do you see as the next step in this evolving debate, controversy, whatever you want to call it, over sanctuary cities and sanctuary policies? Are you anticipating a long, drawn-out court battle, or what's next? What are you getting ready for?
Yeah, I mean, I think court battles, I think, are likely. And so I think that's something we want to think about and keep an eye out for. I also think a very big part of this, and this will be very challenging, is actually having coordination among cities. It's a very diffuse and diverse set of cities, right, that are potentially at risk here of losing their funding, and how we're able to stand together and have our partners in the immigrant rights movement stand with us when we are going to face some real challenges. That, I think, it remains to be seen. And I think that level of coordination is something that we've not had to do to this degree in the past. And so I think we're sort of preparing and thinking about how we work together, not just sort of individually, how we fight back and continue to protect immigrant communities.
So there's definitely a shift that's occurred in terms of at least the conversation that's going on.
I think so. I mean, I think the executive order has made this issue around sanctuary jurisdictions, so-called sanctuary jurisdictions, much more real. That said, you know, last year, maybe it was 2015, there were bills that were moving through Congress that were trying to pull funding from so-called sanctuary cities. And cities were able to come together along with many others to push back against that legislation, and it didn't pass in Congress. And the arguments that we made, they wanted to tag community development block grant funding and criminal justice funding. And I think just on its face, right, for a city like New York, it would have cost us $150 million in community development block grant money. That's money for small business training. That's money for community revitalization. None of this is smart policymaking. And I think we want to fight back sort of in that same way, kind of showing what we're really talking about here and doing that as a collective of cities as much as we can.
Kemi Bello, if somebody wants to put together a preparedness plan, where do they go?
They can visit our website at www.ilrc.org and find one of our family preparedness plans.
Thank you very much. I want to thank all three of you, Lena Graber and Kemi Bello from the Immigrant Legal Resource Center in San Francisco, and Commissioner Nisha Agarwal, Commissioner of the New York City Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you.
The Feet into Worlds podcast is produced by Rachel Bongiorno and Rosalind Tordesillas, with additional help from Jocelyn Gonzalez and Stephanie Rodriguez. Our engineer is Katie McMurrin at the studios of KQED. Feet into Worlds is supported by the Ralph E. Ogden Foundation, the David and Catherine Moore Family Foundation, and listeners like you. To make a contribution, visit our website at fi2w.org. That's fi2w.org. Feet into Worlds, telling the stories of today's immigrants to the rest of America. Thanks for listening. I'm John Rudolph.